From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Well, good morning. Not Dave Graham again today. Dave's taking another day off, so Rick Singeri in for Dave Graham here on the Dave Graham Show. Nature, a key focus of our show today. We'll be visiting a town forest to discuss how wildlife ecology and forest management, and yes, that means logging responsibly, can be beneficial to our ecosystem. Then after we check in with journalist Bob Ney to get an update on what's happening in the rest of the country and the world, we'll get to tweeting. Well, we'll be talking about birds with Chip Darmstead. He's co-host of the WDEV program For the Birds. Let's start the program by welcoming Andrea Shortsleeve. She's a wildlife biologist at Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Andrea, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
And Ethan Tapper is the Chittenden County Forester. Ethan, welcome to WDEV.
Thanks, Rick.
Now, listeners, this is your opportunity to ask questions about the best way to protect our wildlife and how forest management can accomplish that. You can call 802-244-1777. That's 244-1777. Toll free 1-877-291-8255. Do you have reservations about logging within a town forest? You can ask your questions and to either Andrea or Ethan at 802-244-1777. Well, the two of you will be giving a virtual presentation in a couple of weeks on the work being done at the Andrews Community Forest in Richmond. So let's start there and look at it from both of your perspectives. Andrea, first, describe the wildlife ecology of this town forest.
Yeah, it's a really cool piece of property just in terms of where it's sitting in the Champlain uphills, and then also just kind of on a local sense. It's got a lot of different natural communities and habitat features for a variety of wildlife, going from large mammals like black bears all the way down to small little salamanders and invertebrates. So it's a really cool piece of property that fits into kind of a larger conserved landscape, and it's really important that people can appreciate that.
How big is this town forest?
It's a little over 400 acres.
Wow. Is that typical of town forests around the state, about that size?
I'll let Ethan jump in on that
one. All right. Yeah, let's go to the forest side. And Ethan, how does this compare to town forests that we have in Vermont?
So we have town forests of all shapes and sizes. We have some that are over 1,000 acres and some that are as small as 100, a little over 100 acres. So there's all different shapes and sizes. In Chittenden County, there's about a dozen of them, comprising in total about 4,200 acres. Mm-hmm. And our biggest one is the Hinesburg Town Forest, which is 864 acres. The smallest one is probably the Westford Town Forest, the Maple Shade Town Forest, which is about 130. It used to be that there was a town forest program in the state which provided special assistance to municipalities who are acquiring town forests. Town forest has to be officially designated. And then they were subject to or able to access all this different grant funding and stuff like that. But now a town forest we consider to be any parcel of forested land that's owned by a municipality, and there's a lot of them. Towns get them in all different kinds of ways. There's a lot of them out there, and there's sort of like an interesting thing about which ones are town forests that we call town forests and which are parcels of just town-owned forested lands of all different shapes and sizes. So it's hard to, you know, what's a town forest, what's not a town forest. That designation is a little bit more fluid right now.
Well, Ethan, from your perspective, what sets apart or what makes this Andrews Community Forest in Richmond quite interesting to you?
So the interesting thing about all town forests is that, you know, because they're managed at a smaller scale, they're owned by a municipality, they're usually managed by a committee of volunteers, a town forest committee or a conservation commission. They are like really agile. And so there's an opportunity to really reflect the character and the values of an individual community in the town forest. So the town, you know, the way we do management on the town forest, the Andrews Community Forest in Richmond might be different from the way that we do management on the Hinesburg Town Forest in Hinesburg or the Catamount Community Forest in Williston. Specifically, some of the really cool stuff about Andrews, it is, as Andrea mentioned, in this area that we call the Chittenden County Uplands. This was a big conservation project that was started in the early 1990s, and the goal was to protect as much land in this certain area of Chittenden County as intact forest blocks as possible. And so it's part of this massive connected forested landscape, which is comprised of both public and private land. In terms ecologically, it's on the south-facing slope in the Winooski River Valley, so it has some really cool sort of what we call like dry site conditions, which give us lots of red oak and beech and stuff like that, and some really unique deer wintering conditions. And sort of on an even finer scale, there are specifically some unusual forest types within the Andrews Community Forest. The property is protected with a conservation easement held by the Vermont Land Trust, and they identified some really special, unique sites like red pine forest, dry oak forest, vernal pools, which are really important amphibian breeding habitats. So there's also those, sort of on a finer scale, those really cool opportunities for wildlife.
So, Ethan, what is the forest management project that you're working on there?
So I've been working really hard with communities, especially over the last 2 winters with the Hinesburg Town Forest, and prior to that with the Preston Pollock Conservation Area, which is a town forest in Bolin. And the goal of all of these projects is to, you know, number one, to manage a really healthy forest, you know, for everything, for wildlife, for ecosystem services, and even as a contribution to the working landscape in these different communities. But also to demonstrate responsible forest management. So, you know, I think in some cases, for good reason, there is a certain stigma around forest management, logging. It's been done poorly in many cases, and in other parts of the world it's done really poorly, and in Vermont's history there's certainly a fair amount of not super high-quality forest management, but there's also opportunities to use forestry to really, really support all the values in our forest that we really care about, from wildlife habitat to clean air and clean water to producing local renewable resources, and to do it in a way that's regenerative, that's not just extractive. And so one of the ways that I'm trying to tackle helping people manage their forested land better, and I should say that in Vermont we're 75% forested, 80% of those lands are owned by private landowners, so it's really, really important to help private landowners understand how to manage their land, for forested lands well. My goal is to increase understanding of what responsible forest management looks like, and to sort of provide a lot of different opportunities throughout this process to expose all different kinds of people coming from all different kinds of places to what responsible forest management looks like, and to learn about sort of the different elements of it. So that's sort of in a nutshell. And there's a lot of different parts to that, but what I really think is that most people are actually in favor of forest management. They just don't know it yet. And there's a lot of really, really important, good ways that we can interact with the forest.
Andrea Shortsleeve, how do you interact or provide input on a forest management project like this?
For the town forest aspect, you know, I work with Ethan when there's questions about different wildlife features and how they can be incorporated into the town forest, the management plan. And then I do a lot of help with the outreach and kind of explaining to people who are coming to our walks, you know, before COVID happened and now our webinars, on how the forest management that Ethan's talking about, how that can translate into improving wildlife habitat and what you want to look for when you're doing things like this on your own property.
I'm going to ask you both this question. I'll start with you, Andrea. What are you hoping to accomplish with this plan at Andrews?
I think one of the biggest things that I'm looking for from my perspective is kind of taking an active role in working with landowners and the public, and showing people how you know, our local forests and our conserved properties play a larger role in kind of our conserved landscape, and also how you can make that happen on your own property and just kind of start to appreciate the things that we have right in our backyard, and how that can play into Vermont's larger wildlife population.
Ethan, your goal at Andrews Community Forest in Richmond?
The goal really is to improve understanding, number one, of how forests work. You know, I think a lot of the perceptions that people have about logging is is in many cases based on an incomplete understanding of how forests work. So what we know about forests now, and the science increasingly backs up and enriches our understanding of them, is that they're these really complex systems. Our forests are in many cases recovering from really, really intensive human land use and are not like the forests that may have preceded European settlement. And we actually have opportunities to help make our forests more like old growth forests, more like these natural, really diverse, really complex forests using active management. So forests are supposed to look messy. Old growth forests look really messy, and it's not just this sort of park-like, aesthetically pleasing kind of appearance that most people think. There's all different shapes and sizes of trees. There's dead wood on the forest floor. There's trees that have fallen over. There's, all kinds of these different sort of features that most people would regard as messy or wasteful, but they're actually the same features that really provide a rich, sort of holistically healthy forest environment, not just for trees, but for all of the other different organisms that make trees grow and make forests work, from, microinvertebrates in the soil to fungi in the soil that we now understand to be very important to helping trees communicate with each other and share resources with each other, all the way up to our megafauna like black bear and white-tailed deer. So help people understand how forests work naturally, and then the second part is understanding the role that forest management can have that can be, not scary, but actually really positive and exciting and compelling in our world. And so how can active forest management, logging, be managed in a way that is actually supporting all these values you really care about and is actually making forests healthier? And so there's sort of two sides of that. So number one, the ecology. So how is the work that we're doing positively influencing forest ecology, and how can it really help our forests be more rich and more complex and more diverse? And then there's this other side of it that I'm also really excited about, which is thinking about the social benefits. So what is the benefit of, if we can manage forests in a really good way, producing local renewable resources and supporting our working landscape and the culture and the character of our communities? I think that if you can produce local renewable resources, in this case wood, while you're making the forest healthier, why wouldn't you want to do that? And so part of that is sort of unwrapping this stigmatization of forest management as a concept and helping people understand how it's so much more nuanced, and there are ways to do it in a way that I think we can all be really proud of.
That's Ethan Tapper. He's the Chittenden County Forester. Also speaking with Andrea Shortsleeve from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife. She's a biologist with VFW, and we're taking your calls today. If you have questions about forest management, if you want to know about a town forest in your area, or you want to discuss wildlife ecology here in the state, these are the two people you really want to pose a question to. The number here is 802-244-1777. That's 802-244-1777. Toll free, 877-291-8255, 877-291-TALK. Andrea, what are the biggest concerns for the wildlife in our state?
That's a big question.
It is a big question.
I think a lot of the concerns that we have come down to habitat quality, making sure that we have, a healthy supply of native plants and food sources for our wildlife. And so that includes things like, controlling invasive species, which we talk a lot about, both plants and insects in the forest, making sure that our forests continue to be healthy and produce, the food supply that our wildlife needs. And then, of course, one of the biggest issues, I think, is just forest fragmentation. As Ethan mentioned, the majority of our state is forested. But as more and more people are moving to the state, our forests are getting kind of chopped up. And a lot of our wildlife species really need larger, connected interior forest blocks so they can maintain their life cycles and move back and forth between populations. And we just need to make sure that our forest blocks are continue to be connected and intact. And that's especially important as we look to the future and we see that the climate's going to be changing. We need to make sure that our forests continue to be resilient and available for our wildlife species to be moving back and forth throughout the state and throughout the region.
Yeah, explain how that fragmentation does affect the state's wildlife and them being able to move freely around and why they need to.
Yeah, I think one of the easiest examples that people can really understand is looking at the impact that roads have on the movement of animals. It's pretty obvious when you're driving down I-89 that it's a pretty large obstacle for a lot of wildlife to get across, and it pretty much bisects our state. And so when you start thinking about connectivity and how wildlife moves from area to area, big roads like that really kind of impact their ability to move, but also just the way that Vermonters have kind of settled in the state. We are a very rural state, so the majority of our population lives in the woods. And so we like to have our long driveways and our houses in the woods, and that's part of the charm of living in Vermont. But it also really kind of creates a larger impact on our wildlife species than I think a lot of us realize. A lot of our native wildlife species prefer to be kind of in an interior forest, away from homes and pets and loud machines. And so the more that we kind of fragment our forests and subdivide our big forest properties, the bigger impact that's going to have on our wildlife.
Yeah, so how does a forest management plan then help with those challenges?
Well, I think
I can jump in on that.
All right, go ahead, Ethan.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing that I often say is that something that is far scarier to me than bad logging is forest loss and forest fragmentation, because that's ostensibly permanent. And, you know, forests can recover from bad logging. It takes a long time. They take multiple generations of trees. You know, it could be hundreds of years if it's really bad. We can't grow forests and we can't produce wildlife habitat if our forests are gone. And so it's this really interesting thing where, of course, everybody wants to live in Vermont because it's beautiful. We have clean air and we have clean water. And we have all these amazing forest-based recreational opportunities, and we all enjoy it all the time. Even if you're just driving to work and you're like, wow, I'm driving, you know, and it's really, I'm surrounded by these green mountains and they're beautiful. Well, the green on those mountains is forests, you know, and so it's this interesting thing where, you know, the more we love the forest, sometimes we can sort of love it to death, right? Where we, you know, we want to live here because it's so beautiful, and then so we put houses everywhere, and so then we lose some of the aspects of it that make it so beautiful. And so, you know, one thing that we really, really need to do, and this is especially apparent in Chittenden County where I work as compared to other parts of the state, is figure out ways where, yes, people can live here, but we can do it while protecting the forest and the public benefits they provide. So again, you know, even though 75% of the state is forested, 80% of those lands are owned by private landowners. Those private lands are producing massive public benefits. So they're producing clean air and clean water for all of us. They're sequestering and storing carbon to mitigate the effects of climate change for all of us. They're providing wildlife habitat for all of us. And even aesthetics, you know, the experience of living in a beautiful place for all of us. And so helping people understand how to manage their forest responsibly in a continuous way so that we protect those benefits is like the most important thing we can do. And in some cases, that's what a forest management plan is all about. It's saying, okay, we have a landowner. The landowner has certain objectives and stuff that's really important to them and stuff they really love about their property. So how do we take that and filter it through best practices, as we know, to manage the forest for all these different benefits, in order to protect that forest for that landowner, yes, but then for all of us, for the community, for the state.
244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. Those are the numbers to call. And let's take a call from Forbes in East Corinth. Morning, Forbes. What's your question or comment today?
I have a couple of questions, if you could bear with me.
Sure.
The logging, actual logging operations of any of these forest. What system is being used? Is it conventional logging or cutting or fellow buncher and chip operations?
Ethan, I think that's your question.
I couldn't really hear him, Rick. What did you say?
Oh, want to know the system used for logging that you're doing for these town forests as you do the forest management plan?
Like the equipment that we're using or sort of the philosophy that we're using?
Forbes?
Yes. I didn't hear that, but you could relate that to me.
Okay. So
I'll answer both things, Rick. How about
okay. That?
That
sounds great.
So, the system that the type of forestry that I practice, and I think that is increasingly practiced by foresters both on private and public lands, is something called ecological forestry. So this idea is that, you know, for a long time, if you go back to the early 1900s, the goal of forest management was largely to grow trees to be harvested, you know, as a resource, just like you grow a field of corn or something like that. Now, what we understand is that forests are these incredibly complex systems. There's many different parts that make it work, which obviously they're dominated by trees. That's how we sort of all identify forests, but also includes wildlife and fungi and all these other things that have talked about soils. And so the idea of ecological forest management is, instead of saying, how do we grow a forest to produce, you know, the maximum benefit for us, it's how do we grow a forest responsibly to, yes, also produce an output of wood when it's appropriate to do so, but to do so within the context of the way that forests naturally grow and develop. So, like, how do we take cues from what we understand about the way that forests naturally work to guide how we're actually going to manage them? And so, you know, the way that this is sort of applied is that the forest management looks different. Like, it may look in some ways messier. It's not going to look like a plantation of all one species of trees that are all perfectly evenly spaced. It's going to look more like an old growth forest where it's messy and there's different sizes and shapes of trees and there's different species of trees and there's all dead wood on the forest floor and, you know, all these different types of habitats and microenvironments and stuff like that. It's applied in a way where the tenet is not, you know, that is guiding us is not simplicity and uniformity and production. It's complexity and diversity and structure, all these other things that are really important to natural forests and maybe not intuitively important to sort of production forests if we're just trying to grow wood, but actually allow us to grow wood in the long term, allow us to continue to have holistically healthy forests that produce wood forever, but also are producing all of these other benefits that have extreme importance as well. And so then it's really interesting, you know, how do we actually do that on the ground? And we do it by, you know, what I learned in school is manipulating vegetation, right? So that means cutting trees. So what we're doing is we're simulating natural disturbances by cutting trees in a specific way. Those trees are getting pulled out of the woods and processed into different products. Some of them are getting processed into saw timber, which is going to get sawed up into boards, or dimensional lumber that we use to build our houses. Some of that's going to get turned into firewood and other things. And to do that, we're using the smallest type of logging equipment, which is usually available. There are smaller types, but in less widespread use. It's called a cable skidder. It's like a big tractor with a cable winch on the end that basically skids or drags the trees out of the woods.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, here, the ultimate naturally is to have a good forest when you finish. My point is, most of our operations today are what they call a feller buncher, with a piece of equipment that actually cuts the tree, puts it in a pile, and then a grapple skidder picks up the entire tree, takes it out
right.
to be cut into logs, and then chipped the balance. My question, and of course the argument, is that it leaves nutrient level to break down over a period of time for the remaining tree. Also, cover for small animals, partridge, rabbit, whatnot, for protection.
Right. Yeah, so I think that, you know, interestingly, you know, there's definitely a place for both things. So in mechanized systems, like, you know, they have a number of different positive attributes that I think are useful in certain contexts, and there are other contexts where I would prefer to use something like a cable skidder. And one of the reasons I really like cable skidders is just like because you mentioned, we actually want to leave a lot of deadwood in the forest. You know, we want to leave the tops of those trees in the forest for cover for wildlife, also to provide a little shelter for the new seedlings that are going to spring up following the work that we do, protect them from deer browse. and, you know, to further enrich those soils. So there's a lot of benefits with that. There's also context, you know, where that those mechanized systems can be useful. Like, for instance, on my own property, I used a mechanized system because my property had been what's called high-graded, so logged very extractively. Almost all the trees of value had been removed, and those high-production systems, you know, can turn a lower-value product into they can still make a forest with a lot of lower-value wood into something that's commercial and still get it done. So what I needed to do to heal my forest from the work that had been done in the past was to start over in a couple of places, and they were able to do that. So the other thing, you know, about mechanized systems is that they are a lot safer. So one thing we really need in the forest is we want more loggers. We want loggers who are responsible and thoughtful. And, you know, cutting down a tree with a chainsaw and, you know, getting out and working in the woods and hooking that tree up by hand is a lot more dangerous than the work that mechanized skidders do. So I think both things are important. In this job, we're really trying to leave that dead wood component, and so that kind of mechanized harvesting was not appropriate. But I think there's also situations where I would do mechanized logging and feel really good about it, just in a different situation.
We're almost going to a break for the CBS News, Ethan, so I hope this is a short answer. But with a 400-acre town forest like the one in Richmond, about how much logging, about what percent, when you go in with a management plan, would you take away?
So, unfortunately, it's not a short answer.
All right. Well, then let's hold that for after the break. Yeah. We're going to let me tell everyone what we're doing. I'm speaking with Andrea Shortsleeve and Ethan Tapper, and we are talking about forest management, wildlife ecology in a town forest, and we will get to how this impacts you and your private lands. If you want to call in, 802-244-1777, 1-877-291-8255.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Zingari in for Dave Graham. My guests are Andrea Shortsleeve, a wildlife biologist at the Vermont Fish and Wildlife, and Ethan Tapper. He's the Chittenden County Forester. We're discussing forest management and wildlife ecology. Listeners, feel free to share your thoughts or ask Ethan and Andrea a question. You can call 802-244-1777, toll free 1-877-291-8255. And Ethan, right before the break, I launched a question that was going to take a little more time, but with a town forest like you're working on right now, the Andrews in Richmond, that's about, I think you said 400 acres, and you go in, and I know until you kind of do your research and figure it out, and I know you're not looking to say we're going to get rid of 25% of this forest, but, you know, in a project like this, about how much wood do you remove? How much logging would go on?
Right. So there's I wrote a forest management plan for the Andrews Community Forest back in, I guess it was last year, 2019.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about that forest management plan is that we divided it up into three different zones. So there's three different zones within which different levels of management are allowed. So, for instance, a third of the property is a reserve zone. So that's a zone in which no forest management will occur at all. We're working in now what's called Zone 2, which is a moderate intensity zone. In this area, no mechanized harvesting is allowed, and we're basically using this ecological forestry approach and creating smaller openings. You know, on the aggregate, we're not turning any forest into non-forest. We're basically cutting trees to create disturbances which will stimulate natural regeneration. So it'll be, you know, the harvest area is about 100 acres. It'll be 100 acres of forest at the end of this and forever. that is also conserved. But of that area, probably about 20% of it will be harvesting in these groups that are up to it. So these are patches up to an acre in size. Most of them will be smaller than that, but that'll be about 20 acres. Of the harvest area also, we're keeping 20 acres as an unmanaged control, which will then be kept as unmanaged in perpetuity. So that'll allow people to go into the area that we've worked in, go into the area that is ostensibly the same or very similar, but we haven't done the work, and basically compare and contrast between those areas.
Yep.
So it's a complicated, you know, one of the interesting things that differs from between ecological forest management and, you know, sort of old school forest management is that in old school forest management, you would grow a generation of trees. You would at some point determine that they were, quote unquote, economically mature, which is a distinction which has to do with their value, not with their biological maturity or the maturity of the forest as a system. And then you would cut them all, right? And so then you would, like, you know, at some point you do a thinning and you'd reduce the density, the number of trees, by about half or, you know, probably less than that, somewhere midway in that process. And then, you know, at year 100 or whatever, you would cut them all. And so with ecological forest management, we're harnessing the fact that forests develop continuously. So never or very infrequently are these forests being completely regenerated, are all the trees being removed. Instead, what we see in old growth forests is that there's this constant patchwork of different patches, what we call groups and canopy gaps being created by mortality, and that these gaps and these, you know, little pockets of regeneration are actually a huge part of what makes forests so healthy. So as we as humans may find death and disturbance and change to be really unpleasant, but within forests as a system, the death of trees can be actually really profound and contribute to all these really positive parts of natural forest development. One really interesting just factoid is that there's been research that's shown that dead wood actually has more living biomass in it than living wood. And the reason for that is because, you know, the living part of a tree is actually sort of a thin veneer on the outside of the tree, whereas dead wood is just rich with all of this, you know, invertebrates and fungi and amphibians and all of these other things. And the same is true, you know, sort of applied at a broader scale, where these small scale disturbances as the forest as a system continuously develop, trees falling over, gaps being created, are actually these profound sort of life-giving events.
Well, I want to bring Andrea back in here, Andrea Shortsleeve. So as, you know, this 20% is taken away from this town forest, paint the picture then of, you know, how that affects the wildlife ecology, what we see now in those spaces, you know, that that makes this management plan worthwhile and necessary.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it has to do with the way that the trees are removed and the areas that are picked for harvest. So in some areas that are really kind of over decadent, or they're full of trees that are just kind of not producing any more food for wildlife, we'll go in and remove a large patch of them and basically restart the forest into what we call a young forest patch or early successional habitat. And these areas are extremely valuable for all sorts of wildlife. They create habitat for pollinators, for songbirds come from all over to feed in the new growth and the berries that are produced. And then it's also places where mammals are going to be seen eating the raspberries, eating the new shoots that grow up. And so they can be really productive areas. You know, other forest practices that we'll be working on will be things like releasing mast trees. So releasing trees that produce acorns and beech nuts and berries, and opening them up so they can produce even more food and be healthier in the long run. And so it really just kind of depends on the different forest management activity that is prescribed in that area. And it's really going to benefit wildlife in a variety of ways.
Andrea, let's talk about the presentation that you have coming up on the 15th. What will people see and hear?
Well, we're going to be doing kind of a virtual slideshow using PowerPoint. We're going to talk about how the Andrews Community Forest fits into a larger landscape perspective in Vermont, and then kind of zoom down and show how important that is in the local community. You know, I'll focus on things that you can find in the forest, some of the vernal pools, the the MAS stands for the bears, the deer wintering areas, and talk about how important those are for wildlife and how you can replicate some of these activities on your own property to enhance wildlife habitat, whether you have a half-acre property or a large forest block. And Ethan will talk more about kind of the specifics of the forest management plan and what is planned for the next couple of years of the forest.
Who's invited? How do they take part?
Everyone's invited. That's the beauty of doing these webinars. You know, I think anyone who's interested in learning a little bit more about forest ecology and wildlife and the things that we've been talking about today are welcome to tune in. The event's going to be hosted by Coverts, which is a great cooperative landowner group run by Lisa Sodsville. And they can, people, if you're interested in tuning in, you can jump onto Facebook, and Coverts has a registration link available there.
All right. Ethan, forest management is logging. It involves logging. You know, it's everything that logging is. It's a little more planned. It's more ecological. But these are town forests, you know, they're protected, they're there to serve the community as a place of refuge, right? So how do you square logging in this place that really should just be preserved?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing is that I think about it, you know, I call it forest management instead of logging, or I think about logging as a tool that we use in forest management because forest management is so much more than that, right? So we're using, you know, this traditional method of cutting trees to also pursue these much higher objectives. And so, you know, there's a lot of benefit, I think, to these local communities of, number one, having a healthy forest. And again, I think that we're doing it in a way that's going to make these forests healthier, that will improve the wildlife habitat, that will make them more resilient to climate change and all these other things, using logging as a tool. And then also, I think that a lot of these towns are really proud to use their town forest to demonstrate responsible management. Like folks in Hinesburg at the Hinesburg Town Forest, I think are really proud that the Hinesburg Town Forest is a place where people learn about responsible forest management. You know, this webinar, you know, is trying, it's actually part of a virtual event series that we're doing. Over the last two winters, I've done these events in person, and obviously we can't do that right now.
Right.
I've done all these events that are highlighting different parts of the forest management at the Hinesburg Town Forest and just showcasing that. And I think it's something that while, you know, some folks in Hinesburg, you know, might have had a little bit of resistance to it or, you know, not understood what it was about or why we'd be doing that, I think that that community and the people I worked with in Hinesburg are really proud of that. And I think that people in Richmond similarly want to emulate how responsible forest management, what it looks like, and how other people can learn about that in a way that's going to benefit the broader landscape. So the other thing is that we're not just doing one thing on this town forest. So this is also a place for recreation. This is also a place where not all areas are managed, so we're protecting rare and sensitive natural communities. We're doing all the things, and so it's many things. There are areas that people will be able to go to that are completely unmanaged forever. There are areas that people are able to go to that were recently managed very aggressively before it was a town property, and so look a little bit different. And there are areas that people are able to go to where they'll be able to see this sort of responsible forest management. So I think that, you know, these town forests are multiple use, and we can do all those things.
Andrea, when we're talking about these forest management projects, what kind of wildlife diversity do they promote? Do they enhance?
In terms of the wildlife species?
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of the work we do is focused on improving songbird habitat. And so we talk about birds a lot because they're easy for people to watch and they're fun for people to watch. So a lot of the work we do focuses on birds, but really any of the management is going to improve the habitat for a variety of species. So at the Andrewstown Forest, we know that we have turkeys, we have deer, we have black bears running through, and we also have a lot smaller wildlife. So we have things like our native pollinators, our native bumblebees, small salamanders and wood frogs that are going to be hanging out in the vernal pools there. And then just kind of the whole gamut. We have bats, we have small mammals, just everything that's there.
Ethan, we once went down to around 30% forested land in Vermont, probably in the 1800s when sheep farming was the thing here in the state. We're now up over 70%, I think somewhere around 73-75% of Vermont being forested. So aren't we doing an amazing job of reforesting this state?
We are. And I mean, I should say that most of that reforestation was passive. So it's just, you know, old fields naturally regenerating back to forests. You know, the stuff that we're not doing well is that, you know, while it's 75% forested, what that can hide is an increasingly fragmented and subdivided landscape. So those, you know, might not be the same as these big, huge blocks that might have preceded that, you know, really intensive land use of the 1800s. The difference, and this is really, really important, the difference between the forest that we have now and the forest that we had prior to the 1800s is that forests as systems develop over hundreds or thousands of years. And so the forests that we have now, you know, in many cases were a field 100 or less than 100 years ago. They haven't had time to regain that structural complexity, many different sizes and ages of trees, big, huge, old trees, lots of dead wood on the forest floor, these things that we see in old growth forests. They haven't had time to recover those features. And that's sort of one of the most compelling things I think about the work that I do is we understand that having a diversity of different tree species, tree sizes and ages, patches of different sizes with young forest in them, old trees on the, you know, dead trees on the ground, all of these are features that also support a wide variety of different wildlife species. For instance, there are songbirds that need young forest, songbirds that need old forest, songbirds that need a mix of all different sizes and shapes of trees. And they really need it now because we're in the midst of globally, you know, a pretty huge reduction of global biodiversity, and our forests could be supporting, you know, a wider range of different wildlife and supporting these species that require that complexity in the forest that we don't have yet. So one of the exciting things, while forests hopefully will continue to grow and develop those attributes on their own, we can make them more complex using intervention now. And so that's one of the really important things is understanding that this actually has standalone benefit in that we're sort of restoring forests using logging and forest management as a tool to conditions that would, number one, are more like how natural forests grow, and then number two, are also providing these discrete benefits to wildlife and also makes them more resilient to climate change, and it also, you know, increases their ability to be to continue to produce clean air and clean water and all of these other ecosystem services that we appreciate.
Ethan mentioned earlier that 80% of that forested land is privately owned. So I'll put this to both of you. Andrea, you first. What can people do on their own properties to help forests and, by extension, to help wildlife?
One of the biggest things that I talk to people about is enhancing native plants. I mentioned that earlier, and kind of being able to identify and control the invasive plants that are on their property. I think that's one of the biggest things that, you know, a landowner can do just regardless of the size of their property. Other than that, just enhancing the diversity of your property. So in terms of focusing on different species that you have growing in your forest and also the structural diversity. So the things that Ethan talked about earlier, like leaving wood on the ground, is going to be really important for a variety of wildlife. Leaving standing dead trees, snags, another really important thing that people can do at very minimal effort in your forest.
And Ethan, how about you? What do you prescribe people on their own properties do to help forests?
So to add on to what Andrea said, again, I think, you know, probably the most important thing is for me is to keep forests as forests and to keep them unfragmented, undeveloped, or, you know, to minimize the effect of development on these, you know, the health of the forest as a whole and the wildlife that utilize it. And so there's a bunch of different ways you can do that. Conserving your property permanently with a Vermont Land Trust or a local land trust makes it so that your property can never be subdivided or developed. Putting your property in the current use program, the use value appraisal program, that's a program that the county foresters manage, which is a tax abatement program for properties larger than 25 acres where landowners have to have a forest management plan that's developed by a licensed forester, and they have to follow their forest management plan. So it helps, and they can't subdivide or develop without paying a penalty. And so it helps incentivize keeping forests as forests, and also helps, I think, improve the quality of forest management because they have to follow this forest management plan. Another really important thing, demographically, we know that most of our forest landowners are older. And so making sure that as lands pass from generation to generation, that you do some sort of planning to make sure that as that land passes to the next generation, that it's not going to get developed. It's not going to get subdivided or in other ways sort of lost. And there's a whole growing focus in the conservation community around what we call forest succession planning. So those are ways that landowners can put their lands in different kinds of structures that will basically ensure that your wishes with respect to your forested land are respected after you're gone. And their Vermont Woodlands Association especially has a lot of these really amazing workshops on forest succession planning, as does Vermont Coverts, which is the organization that is sponsoring the event on the 15th. Those things to me are incredibly important. And, you know, because we can't do good forest management, we can't have good wildlife habitat if we don't have forests.
Ethan, how optimistic are you that segmentation of our forest lands can be corrected?
Well, so, you know, fragmentation is very difficult to reverse because a lot of those, you know, it's fragmented with roads, driveways, houses, which take a long time to go away.
Right.
But I am optimistic that we can stem, you know, we can slow the process down and we can develop our communities in a smarter way. Again, like, Vermont's the best, and so, you know, everybody, you know, should be able to come here if they want to come here and enjoy all the amazing benefits that we have. But as they do that, we need to do that without destroying the forest, which are the source of many of these really, really cool benefits. So what I tell people is that, you know, if you are a forested landowner, conservation, succession planning, enrolling your property in current use, these are all really important things. Also, just as a community member, you know, one of these volunteer groups that govern the development of our communities, planning commissions, development review boards, you know, these town plans that towns develop, these are really like ground zero of where we make the rules about how we develop our communities, and we can make rules that make it so that we are minimizing the effect of the development in our communities on our forested lands and keeping the forested blocks that we still have that are intact and the sensitive natural resources that we have from being affected by development fragmentation and stuff like that.
Andrea, so tell everybody one more time where they can access the presentation that's happening on Tuesday, September 15th at 7 p.m.
Yeah, it's through Coverts.
Go ahead, Andrea.
I was just going to say it's through Coverts group. You can go on their Facebook page, and our Fish and Wildlife Facebook page also has a link to register for the event.
All right. That's Andrea Shortsleeve, wildlife biologist at Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Also, Ethan Tapper, Chittenden County Forester. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thanks
for having us.
And CBS News is next. Then we'll be back to talk with journalist Bob Ney. And then all things birds with Chip Darmstadt of the North Branch Nature Center here on WDEV, The Dave Graham Show.
Itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And good morning. Welcome back to the Dave Graham Show. I'm Rick Singeri in for Dave. And just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from journalist Bob Ney, and we'll be chatting about what's going on in the country, in the world. We'll get a coronavirus update, probably hear about how people are thinking about tariffs right now. There's tensions going on between the U.S. and China, and we'll probably cover that. The president and Joe Biden both visited Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the president also campaigning in Pennsylvania, so a couple really battleground states. We'll get an update on how those things are playing out. Bob will be with us, and then we'll switch over to birds. And if you are a birder or have questions about how to get into birding, if you want to talk about a sighting you've had, maybe need help identifying it, we're going to have Chip Darmstead here. He's the executive director of the North Branch Nature Center. He also co-hosts a show here on WDEV called For the Birds, and he does that with Anson Tebbets. So when you when he comes on, if you have questions about birds, please ring us up at 244-1777, or you can call the toll-free number. It's 877-291-8255. And a reminder that today on WDEV, starting at about 11:05, the governor's COVID-19 news conference, Governor Phil Scott updating us on everything going on in the state's battle against COVID-19. We'll be hearing from Governor Scott and many of the state officials about different aspects of going back to school, about setting up childcare hubs in the state, things like that. That's coming up at 11:05, and that is sponsored by Guy's Farm and Yard. And also, if you missed a show on the Dave Graham Show, you can always listen to a podcast at WDEVradio.com. It's brought to you by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost famous. Now it's time to turn to Bob Ney, the journalist. And Bob, welcome back to the Dave Graham Show.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Always great to have you. First of all, let's start with the coronavirus update on what's going on across the country, across the world.
Yes, you know, you don't hear this every day. It's out there every day, but you just don't actually see the numbers till you look at the what I call the dashboard.
Mm-hmm.
But globally, there's been 867,219 deaths, about 17 million recoveries. In the United States, as of today, the total deaths are 186,785, and recoveries about 2,266,000. Now, the total testing, by the way, has been about 80, according to this, 80 million some tests in America.
Mm-hmm. And total cases, again, of those 80 million?
In America, the total deaths are 186,000, and the total cases are 6 million cases.
And in the last few weeks, are things... you know, are we having, is it been an upswing, a downswing, certain hot spots? What has been going on in the country?
You know, Rick, it's interesting statistically to try to keep up with this. It depends on where, you know, where in the country, whether it's, you know, Florida or certain states. It almost sometimes depends on the counties, you know, in the states. I think statistically it's staying about where it does on the death rate. Worldwide, 0.0001. And so statistically, even though the numbers change, I think, you know, you'll have some go up, some go down, depends on the hot spots in the United States, but statistically it seems to be staying statistically about the same.
All right. Let's turn to tariffs. This has been in the news quite a bit over the last couple of years. And, you know, that was always a point of contention. What do Americans think about tariffs right now? Are we overly concerned about the effect of tariffs?
Well, Rick, it's now changed. This is probably a significant change. The United States consumers are actually getting less concerned about the impact of tariffs on their lives, and this is brand new data. And then, you know, there was consumer concerns about tariffs in April and May, and then there's been a consistent decline. And this is for the, you know, for the full month of August, 65% of U.S. adults say they're at least somewhat concerned about the impact, but it's down 3 points from 68% in the month of July. So, and they say somewhat concerned. And if you look at this, it's a big change if you look historically from when
Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich did the cooperation on the permanent trade for China, which at that point caused eventually, of course, a large escalation in Chinese products. And then people were concerned about tariffs when Trump came in and then he started to push the whole tariff war. People got pretty concerned about prices going up. Seems now, Rick, that they're more on the side of, okay, they're not alarmed about it, which probably gives the Trump administration some wiggle room to continue to battle China on this issue.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about China. I know there have been tensions between China and Australia, different countries, and, of course, tensions between the U.S. and China really accelerating. What's the root of these tensions between these two countries right now?
Well, it's not just TikTok. That's what we hear about all the time. But TikTok kind of lit the match, because when President Trump said, well, we're just going to ban TikTok, the app that, you know, is very kind of controversial. A lot of parents, by the way, don't like TikTok. But when he said we're going to ban it, and I know that, by the way, from my daughter, about my granddaughter using it. But when he said we were going to ban it, that kind of freaked China out in a sense. And so it's been an ongoing potential series of threats from China to withhold intellectual property. And now China's coming back and basically saying maybe they, you know, will continue to affect our supply chain. Give you a concrete example. In Pennsylvania, there's a guy that manufactures these piping parts, and he has, let's say, 122 parts. He has 121 available, and the remaining part comes from China, and it's not here. Mm. So that interrupts the entire supply chain. Intellectual property, too. Same thing. Some of the Chinese companies haven't paid for intellectual property that was done for them. I know there's a case in Tennessee. So the end result, we can look at this and say, wow, you know, China's really bearing down on us, and the supply chain for us is hurt. On the other hand, I think it would be a political opportunity for a candidate or the Congress to say, fine, where are we short in our supply chain? And if we're short in a certain thing in our supply chain, can it be done in New Hampshire or Vermont or Ohio or New York? You know, can we make up for this somewhere? And could the government maybe do some low interest loans that are paid back by the companies as long as they provide these essential supply chain charts? I mean, that's maybe crazy thinking on my part, but that's a potential that might come out of this.
Well, it would certainly affect the trade deficit, which seems to be, I think, at a record high again. And so it would have a knock-on effect very positively for the U.S. in providing jobs in reducing that deficit. Well, let's talk about candidates. First of all, Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential candidate, visited Kenosha, Wisconsin, right after President Trump. How did that visit go?
I think overall the visit went well. Now, you know, Biden suffers from something the president does, and maybe the president does it to himself more, but there was an awkward moment where Joe Biden had started to talk about an issue and said he better be quiet because if he goes on too long, he might get shot. And, you know, it was a tongue-in-cheek comment, but obviously with what's going on there, you know, the comment you don't want to make.
Right.
But overall, the visit, I think, was very good for Joe Biden. The president went down to North Carolina and had a good visit until he made the comment about why don't you vote twice, which, tongue-in-cheek, kidding or otherwise, was obviously not a good comment to make, because then that becomes the story of the day.
They are having their trip-up moments, but probably neither of those are really going to have much legs. But President Trump visited both Wisconsin and then Pennsylvania, a real battleground state to both of them. So how are the two doing in the battleground states, which will probably swing who becomes president in November?
Well, they are. Biden is ahead in certain battleground states like Pennsylvania. Wisconsin becomes closer. Ohio right now tips towards Trump. But I think that this is a very volatile election. Now, I have friends on the left that say this is over with. Biden has too big of a lead. It's done. And I have friends on the right that say Trump supporters will come out. You know, Trump wins. I think both sides are not looking at the, honestly,
Rick, weekly volatility to these things. If you look at these key states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, I mean, the whole country is key, but Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and if you look at the numbers, Biden will tend to be ahead, but then all of a sudden you see something close a little bit, or you see two polls that narrow it. So I think right now, this is Biden's right now, in the sense of the election we're held today. But if you look at how it's going back and forth, I think it's a very volatile election, and the debates are going to really, really impact, I think, this election more than past elections.
We got two important months coming up between right now and Election Day, and we'll be following it very closely. Bob Ney, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
All right.
Have a great day.
You too. Now, even if you're not a birder, you have to be awed by our avian friends. Nothing takes your breath away like seeing an impressive raptor like a falcon, a snowy owl, or bald eagle. And when you step outside and hear that cacophonous symphony of birds singing, or when you spot a great blue heron wading in a nearby pond, these things get me every time. Well, our guest today is here to answer your bird questions, maybe help you identify something that you spotted recently. He's the executive director of the North Branch Nature Center and co-host of For the Birds on WDEV. Chip Darbstadt is our guest. And Chip, thanks for being on the show.
It's a pleasure, Rick. Thanks for asking me to do this.
Oh, absolutely. Listeners, if you have questions for Chip, please call now, 802-244-1777. That's the local number, 244-1777. Our toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. All right, Chip. It's not quite fall on the calendar, but has fall migration of birds started yet?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Even in August. It always surprises me every year that, you know, I've always thought of, I think a lot of people think of September as being prime migration season, even though it's not quite fall, but a lot of birds start moving in August. So some birds are just finishing up the nesting season. I saw some vireos yesterday feeding young out of the nest, but lots of birds are migrating already.
So what does that mean now? What are we seeing coming through Vermont? And where are they coming from, and why do they get that August head start?
Well, I
say head start, but it's probably very natural for them to leave at that time.
It for sure it is. You know, birds, a lot of birds' migration is tied to their nesting cycle. So once a bird is done nesting, you know, after birds leave the nest, in many species, the adults are taking care of the young still. But once they're done with that, some birds are molting. That's a really energetically costly thing to do. So some birds will remain in the general area while until they finish their molt. But then there's really no reason to stay. And as we've already experienced, we start to get some cold nights, and cold doesn't really bother them, but some food resources might become less available to them. So there's really not a lot of reason to stick around once they're done nesting and molting, and birds start thinking about migrating.
Are there specific species that start moving earlier?
You know, it's funny. We don't generally think of sandpipers and shorebirds when we think of Vermont. Right. But quite a few sandpiper species migrate through the state. And there's a few that nest. The spotted sandpipers, one, upland sandpiper, woodcock, killdeer. But they are fairly late migrants in the spring. You may see some northbound migrants in June, and then you're already seeing some southbound migrants in August. So that's just one example, and I think another good example are the nighthawks too. They start moving south in August as well in good numbers.
I once had the opportunity to go out and see and record woodcocks, the male woodcock doing their thing in the mating season. Just describe what that's like. You're not going to see it now. That would have been back, I think, in the spring, but
Like April.
So explain what they do and that sound they make and what that's all about.
Yeah, they are a really wacky bird. Yeah. They nest here at the North Branch Nature Center, and I've actually called in from the North Branch Nature Center this morning and looking out over our field. And in the spring, early spring, like in April, if you go out at dusk, it's hard to see the woodcock. But if you listen very carefully, we have a big rock in the middle of our field, and that's a place I like to sit to listen for the woodcock. You'll hear this peep, 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 and it's the male woodcock. And I should describe it a little bit for people. The male woodcock and the female woodcock look pretty much the same. They're really kind of stocky, plump, yep, shorebirds, sandpipers, with a really long beak. Their beak is probably almost 3 times the length of their head. This incredibly long beak that they use to probe for worms deep in the soil. They can actually move the end of their mandible to grab a worm deep underground. Anyway, the male will be on the ground, and as it's giving that peep call, it's kind of rotating 360 degrees, stopping every so often to give a peep, and then it takes off, and it starts with these kind of zigzaggy flights above the field, and their wings, the outer feathers of their wing, vibrate together, making this twittering sound. And then when they get really high, they start to sing. Yeah. And no one's quite sure how they make the sound, but they call it a song. And as they start to descend, they still sing. And they go in these loops closer and closer to the ground. And they land pretty much where they started. So it's the strangest thing to watch. It's really fun. Once they take off, you can usually spot the woodcock flying high in the air. It's, you know, against the sky. And if you're lucky, if they take off from a place near you, you might actually see them land on the ground and get a good look at them.
All right. We already got calls lined up to talk to you, Chip. This is going to be great. Nancy from Mooresville, thank you so much for calling. Nancy, what's your question for Chip Darmstadt?
Good morning, and thank you. I got to say, first of all, that I do appreciate the show that Anson Tebbets and you do with For the Birds.
Yeah.
I have a
thank
question you. About... do birds work in tandem? And what I'm calling about is early in the season, it was the early nest, robins with young, probably not feathered or barely feathered. This was near my house in a woodlands area. I had seen an unfamiliar small bird, kind of chickadee sparrow size, a warm weather bird, I don't know what it was. It visited a few times, and then it later returned on 2 separate occasions. And one time it was accompanied by a crow that raided the nest. The second time it was accompanied
The robin nest?
Yes. And then the second incident, this little bird showed up. This time, followed almost immediately by what I think was a hawk. So I'm wondering, is that a teamwork kind of a thing or just a coincidence that the predator birds were scoping and alert and just happened to recognize the situation?
And were opportunists. Right. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think a lot of birds are opportunistic. And corvids, like crows and blue jays, they're really smart birds. So birds are just tuned into their environment. So they, you know, the crow might have been watching the nest getting built. It probably is keeping an eye on everything in its environment. And a lot of birds, blue jays, crows, they do raid nests. It's a bird-eat-bird world out there, and a lot of birds will take advantage of that easy meal if they can get to the nest. But it's hard to say whether, the birds are working together. Certainly within a species like blue jays, they're very social birds, and so are ravens and crows, and, they're working together. But that's interesting that, it's almost sounding like there's, something between species, and I haven't heard that before. But I know that birds are really tuned into their environment and always looking for an easy meal,
true,
that's for sure.
All right. Nancy, thanks for that call. Let's go
Thank
to
you.
Linda, who's calling from Addison. Hi, Linda. What's your question for Chip?
So I'm right along the shore of Lake Champlain, and I see a number of birds dive into the water, presumably looking for fish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think they're raptors like osprey, but I don't know what other ones they could be. And would a gull ever do that?
So are they diving from the air or from a perch, Linda?
Oh, from the air.
From the air, yeah. There's quite a few birds that do this. You mentioned osprey. That's a very common bird now on Lake Champlain. So a very large raptor, kind of a black and white checkered pattern. They definitely do that, and they go right under the water to grab the fish. Kingfishers will do that, much smaller than an osprey, and they'll hover. You'll see a kingfisher hovering above the water, and then they'll dive in to catch a fish. Gulls and terns will do that as well. Terns especially will dive into the water to catch fish. And there's one tern in particular, Caspian tern, that has become really common on Lake Champlain. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Linda, but it's got a kind of blood red beak. It's a very large tern. It's as big as some gull species. And gulls will do that from time to time as well. They're very adaptable. We mentioned how opportunistic birds are. I've seen gulls hunting mice in the dunes on the coast. So they certainly will dive in to catch something, but usually it's something on the surface, not so much underwater.
Hey, Chip, how about cormorants? Is that something they would be prone to be doing?
They do dive for fish, but they're doing that from the surface of the water. So they'll be floating, swimming on the surface, and then they'll dive down to catch the fish. I'm trying to think if there's any others it could be. I think those are probably the key ones. Oh. Bald eagle.
Bald eagle. Do they dive or do they try to grab a fish with their talons?
They,
or both?
I don't think they dive quite like an osprey. I think they'd more like get a fish that might be closer to the surface and like get in there with its talons and kind of rake the water and rake up the fish. I don't think they're such expert divers like an osprey. And in fact, they'll often chase osprey. I got to witness this summer. I watched a bald eagle harassing an osprey, chasing it relentlessly for about 5 minutes until the osprey released the fish and the bald eagle swooped in and stole the fish away.
There we go. Again, that opportunistic.
Yes.
Yeah. One other question, and that is I had this fairly large bird land on a tree stump, and, you know, it had a hooked beak, and in its sort of, I don't know, brownish tail, it had three horizontal stripes. What that would be?
Well, a lot of hawks have horizontal stripes on the tail. Cooper's hawk, sharp-shinned hawk, broadwing hawk is. Was this near the water again, or is this just in a more of a forested area?
Yeah, no, near the water.
All right, I'm going to cut you off for just a moment here. We're going to go to a break. CBS News update coming. This gives Chip a little more time to contemplate what that bird might be. And then, Linda, keep listening. We'll try to get an answer for you right after we come back from CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show. If you have a question for Chip, call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And in for Dave, it's Rick Singeri here. We're talking birds with Chip Darmstadt of the North Branch Nature Center. And you can hear him along with Anson Tebbets on Saturdays on WDEV. Great show called For the Birds. And listeners, if you want to chime in today with a question or a comment, 844-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Chip, right before the break, Linda asked a question about identifying a bird. You thought it might be some sort of hawk. You've had some time to contemplate now. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I thought a little bit more about that, and Linda mentioned it was near the water,
right.
And she mentioned she lives on the shores of Lake Champlain. Ospreys actually have a finely barred black and white tail. Mm-hmm. So given her location, osprey seems like the best bet there. They're going to have this checkerboard pattern on the tail and on the underside of the wings. Overall, they're a very black and white bird, white on the chest, dark patch through the eye. So that's probably what she was seeing there.
All right, we're going to go with osprey. You know, Chip, entree into a new hobby can be difficult. So are there tools that make it easier for new birders to get up to speed?
Oh, yeah. I should say, too, that birding is just a great way to get outside, especially,
yeah.
You know, during these COVID-19 times. It's a great outdoor activity that you can do by yourself or in a small group if you're, you know, being safe. So it's a little hard to get started sometimes, though. You're right. I think there's a couple things most birders start with, or if they're just getting into it. One is you need a good field guide, and there's lots of field guides out there. I recommend either one of the Sibley field guides to birds. There's a Eastern Sibley and then one for all of North America. Lots of information packed in there, and it could be a little daunting, I think, for a new birder. I might suggest a Peterson's. Roger Torrey Peterson came out with the first field guide, and it's a classic, and it's what I started with and many birders do. Very great illustrations, very clear suggestions about what to look for, the field marks of a bird, as we say. So a good field guide, like Peterson's Guide to Eastern Birds of North America, or Birds of Eastern North America, rather. And then, of course, we're living in the digital age, so there are lots of apps. Cornell Lab of Ornithology has a great app. It's free. It's called Merlin. And Merlin has two really great features for either a new birder or experienced birders. One is it has a tool that helps you kind of narrow the choices. So you can if you can explore the birds, just kind of going through the list of birds, or you can kind of give an indication of the size and the color, the habitat, and it will narrow the choices and give you more and more questions. And as you answer those questions, it will give you just a couple choices. And very often you can figure out exactly what you're seeing if you get a good look and you work through the process in Merlin. It's very user-friendly. So it's a good identification tool because it walks you through the identification.
Excellent.
And then for birders in general, too, it's just Merlin is full of photos and bird sounds. So they'll give the songs and the calls for all the species that are in Merlin. So it's a great tool for learning birds in your own local area. Also, if you're traveling, you can download packs, they call them. So if you're going out to California, you can download the California Merlin pack.
Wow.
And then you can see what's being seen in California.
I love it. Hey, you ready for more calls?
I am indeed.
Here we go. Let's go to Stephen, who's calling us from Montpelier. Stephen, what's your question for Chip Darmstadt?
Hi, Chip. I have a comment and a question. First of all, I enjoyed birding with Roger Peterson in Connecticut.
Wow.
And one day we camped out at Hammonasset State Park. And in the morning, about 5 o'clock, a bunch of us got up and said, Roger, do you want to go birding? And he said, no, I'm going to lie in my tent for a while. So we went out, and I think we got 35 birds. And then we came back for breakfast, and we said, Roger, you know, no interest in birds. He said, well, I've been lying here in my tent, and I've gotten 71 birds just by ear.
Oh, man.
So that's the father of birding, isn't he?
Wow.
Yeah. So my real question is about hummingbirds and when they migrate south, where they go, and will they come back to where they left here?
Great question.
Mm-hmm. Well, hummingbirds, and by the way, hi, Stephen, a neighbor of the North Branch Nature Center and on our board. Hummingbirds are on the move right now. I did see one this morning. I led a bird walk here at the Nature Center. So they're still around. But, you know, by mid-September, most of them will be gone. Late September, almost all of them. Once in a while, they'll linger longer than that. And they head way south. So they are long-distance migrants. They go down into Central and even South America. I've seen them in places like Costa Rica, for example. So they migrate a long way. They're known for actually migrating across the Gulf of Mexico, believe it or not. And I'm not sure if they do that southbound. I know they do it northbound. So they'll be on the Yucatan Peninsula or in Mexico, and they fly nonstop. They have to, of course, fly nonstop over the Gulf of Mexico. I'm not sure if they do that on their southbound migration or not, or if they funnel through Mexico to get into Central America. But they are an incredible migrant. You know, they're our smallest bird here in Vermont, and they just migrate thousands of miles. It's incredible.
And will the same ones return to Vermont that we saw in years past?
Oh, yeah. They, you know, they will come back often to the same territory. It's often hard to know that for sure. We do bird banding here at the Nature Center, so we see many of the birds we band, we see in later years, subsequent years, chestnut-sided warblers, house wrens, song sparrows. But hummingbirds, a lot of people who band birds generally are not allowed to or can't band hummingbirds because they're so small. And you have to have a special permit to band hummingbirds. So we've never banded hummingbirds here. One thing we'll do if we do catch one is we'll use a nail clipper and clip just a tiny piece off of one tail feather. So we know if we catch it again. So we'll clip maybe the rightmost tail feather, just a tiny bit off the end. But generally, we're not banding them, so it's hard to know if we're seeing the same birds back. But like many birds, I think they are returning to the same area to nest year after year.
I thought you were going to say you were giving the hummingbirds manis and petties. All right, let's take another call. It's time to talk to Fred. Thanks, Stephen. Let's talk to Fred from Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I got two questions. The first question is, how many birds do you have in your life list? And the other question is, have you ever seen a cuckoo?
All right.
Well, we'll start with cuckoos. It's funny. I led a bird walk this morning here at the North Branch Nature Center. And actually, my coworker, Zach Coda, and I both led it, but we split the group up into two. And one group went clockwise around the field, and I went the other direction with half the group. And the other group saw a black-billed cuckoo that we didn't get to see. But they are here. We do see them fairly regularly. I've seen a couple this year, including yellow-billed cuckoo. It's been a great year for yellow-billed cuckoo, especially east of the Green Mountains. They're usually a Champlain Valley species. So yes to cuckoos. They're one of my favorite birds.
And Fred wanted to know how many on your life list.
I'm at 1,999. So,
oh my gosh!
I just need one bird to get to 2,000. So, but you know, these days we're not doing much traveling. I lead bird trips for the Nature Center, and I was going to be leading a trip to Argentina in November. So we would have seen probably several hundred species of birds. So I'm waiting. I have my eyes out for a barnacle goose. They migrate through Vermont in small, very small numbers. They show up. So my guess is my number 2,000 will be a barnacle goose. I got my fingers crossed.
Hope so. All right. And a few years ago, I got to do an owl walk on a full moonlit night at Niquette Bay. It was absolutely brilliant. So, Chip, what kind of birding opportunities does the North Branch Nature Center run? I know you've been talking about doing a walk this very morning.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things going on right now this season. One are the Friday morning bird walks. They're here at North Branch Nature Center. They start at 7:30. And we we'll have two leaders for each of these walks, so we can break up into small groups. You do have to come with a mask. You don't need to pre-register, though. And that is free for members. There's a small fee for non-members, but that's going to happen through September. If you are not ready to venture out, and which I understand, we have an online birding course we've put together. My coworker Zach Coda designed this birding course that you can do online, and there's a small fee for doing that, and you can do it at your own pace. And then many folks out there may know of Bridget Butler, who is the birding diva in Vermont. Bridget is doing a weekend-long course here at the North Branch Nature Center called Slow Birding.
Wow.
And Bridget is an awesome birder. You mentioned owls, Rick.
Yep.
If you ever have the chance, you got to hear Bridget Butler's owl call, her barred owl call. It's the best.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey, give your website address so people can find information on these events.
Sure, yeah. It's North Branch Nature Center, all spelled out, northbranchnaturecenter.org. That slow birding course I mentioned is coming up next weekend, September 12th and 13th. It may be full. I'm not even sure. I went to go look and try to register, and it didn't say it was full, but if it is, it's close.
All right.
So keep an eye on our website. We also, speaking of owls, banned saw-whet owls, migratory saw-whet owls in October. But given where we are with things with COVID-19, we're not sure if we're going to have the groups we had in the past. You know, these were very popular events. We may try to do some small group events. So stay tuned on that. We're still trying to figure out whether or not we can do those owl demonstrations, saw-whet owl banding demonstrations. But if not this year, then certainly next year.
All right. So visit northbranchnaturecenter.org to find out about that for updates. Let's take another call. Pam is calling from Duxbury. Hi, Pam. What's your question or comment for Chip Darmstadt?
Hey there.
Hi.
Stephen anticipated one of my questions about the hummers. So they're still around my house. But I'm just wondering why they're still fighting with one another. The girls seem to just come at the feeder and just sit and drink. The boys come and bob up and down, and then they're all off.
Yeah. Yeah, they are feisty birds, aren't they?
Even if it's not mating season, huh?
Yeah. Well, I think they are just born to be territorial, both during the nesting season and also around food resources. Like hummingbird feeders, those are an anomaly, right? Like, those don't exist in the wild. So out in nature, away from feeders, they have to be aggressive to get to food sources, and they defend patches of flowers. And this is true for hummingbirds all over the world. They're usually very territorial, even around the food resources. So even though there might be like four or five ports for each hummingbird to have its own port, and there's always a human to come refill when they drain it, they still will act territorial and try to drive away other hummingbirds from that food source.
Yes. They don't seem to go after all the flowers I have quite so much, fuchsias and other things. But so another question I had, mm-hmm. Do you ever hear of Chuck Huntington?
Chuck Huntington,
He was a birder in the Brunswick, Harpswell, Maine area, and I was able to go out on field trips with him like at 4:30 in the morning from college, where we'd go down to the coast. He'd always bring donuts, which was always sweet. And the barred owls are still calling. Is that unusual for the fall?
Well, they're pretty vocal. Unlike other owls, they can vocalize almost any time of the year. So I've been hearing them too, and they're an owl that you sometimes even hear during the day. So sometimes you'll hear them do their "Who cooks for you?" call, but they often make these loud screeches. They have a very varied repertoire, and you can pretty much hear them all year long.
Hey, Chip, speaking of owls and raptors, how are our raptors doing in the state? I know some are endangered. So any updates on the raptors in Vermont?
Yeah, I do have one in particular that I think is pretty exciting, bald eagle. I was talking or emailing with Margaret Fowle at Audubon Vermont, and she gave me an update. And these are somewhat preliminary results, but this year there were 40 pairs of nesting bald eagles in Vermont. Isn't that amazing?
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Oh,
and those
love it.
40 pairs produced 65 fledglings, which so it's been a record year. And I was looking at this bar chart, and it was only in 2016, there were about 20 pairs. So the population, the nesting population of bald eagles has doubled in just 4 years. And it was only 2002 when we had our first nesting pair. So there's been an explosion of bald eagles in the state. And I find that pretty exciting.
That is exciting. You know, one thing I think the Nature Center does a great job with is finding citizen science opportunities. So are there any coming up or anything that you want to talk about, highlight, that the North Branch Nature Center is doing?
Yeah, we offer some, and so do other groups like Vermont Center for Eco Studies, VCE, Audubon Vermont. Citizen science or community science is a great way to get involved, use your birding skills, and put it to work for conservation. So one I mentioned earlier, there's an app called Merlin. An associated app is called eBird. And eBird is something I use every day to track my bird sightings, and it's citizen science light, perhaps, because it's, you know, it could be just a casual stroll around your yard, but that's valuable data. So you can get an eBird account through Cornell Lab of Ornithology and log your bird sightings, and that it becomes data that scientists actually use. People might be familiar with Christmas bird counts. I don't know what they're going to look like this year, given the pandemic. But that's something we've been doing for many years here at the North Branch Nature Center. There's there's count circles all over the state. You go out for a single day, usually end of December, beginning of January, and you try to find as many birds and count them, throughout the day. And that data set goes back to the early 1900s. So it's, again, a great way to contribute data to a long-term data set that's been used to help track bird populations.
Well, I know with COVID, you know, there are less opportunities to necessarily get out to some of the great birding spots. But I think you had some great birding opportunities right in your backyard recently.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to go far to see a lot of great birds. Warblers are migrating through the state right now, and I think I may have mentioned this. I went out in my backyard just for about an hour. I live in surrounded by woods, and had 10 species of warbler in about 5 minutes. I probably saw only 20 individuals, but every time I raised my binoculars, it'd be a new species. So there's things like Tennessee warblers migrating right now, Cape May warbler, bay-breasted warbler, chestnut-sided warbler. It's pretty exciting. If you go out, they're hard to find because they are flitting around in the trees, but there's, you know, a couple dozen species of warblers migrating through the state right now.
Just stroll out in your backyard. And very quickly, we're almost out of time, but it's probably important to mention bird feeders and what the rules about what should or shouldn't be up right now.
Yeah, bird feeders should not be up right now, with the exception of hummingbird feeders. Some people put out food for orioles, which is okay. But as you know, and our listeners know, bears love nothing better than to raid bird feeders that are out this time of year. So the best thing to do is to wait until, I think it's after Thanksgiving now. Our winters seem to be more and more mild towards the beginning of the winter, so really bears need to be in hibernation before you're putting out bird feeders. Bears will come out during the day to raid feeders too, so even if you take them in at night, they could easily come by during the day. And then unfortunately you're encouraging a bear who might not be welcome at someone else's bird feeder, so best to wait until they're hibernating sometime after Thanksgiving to put out those feeders.
Chip Darmstadt is the Executive Director of the North Branch Nature Center. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
And thanks to Dana Jewell for directing the show. I'm Rick Sengary. Thanks for listening.